Accession number 16441, Reel 2.
Dr. E, Reel 2.
Yes. Now we were in Woodbury Hall, stationed as a unit called Pioneer Corps 226. Our Major Cochrane was in charge. He was a most friendly commanding officer, Captain Newton, his assistant. And I was there keeping the function of a medical orderly. I was promoted from private to Lance Corporal and finally to Corporal. The reason was that my medical qualification, despite having been already a senior registrar in Czechoslovakia, was not recognized. It was recognized later. However, I carried out all the medical duties, and once a fortnight or once a week came a British qualified medical officer for a short visit. On that occasion, where I stayed for a few months, I also had in my unit a young boy called Hoch. He later changed his name to Robert Maxwell. And he was at the time a very young boy who could not speak English or German or Czech. He only spoke Yiddish. He was most popular. He may have been about 18 or so. And he was sort of considered Benjamin of the unit. A most popular young man.
Why was he so popular?
He was popular because he was young. He was unsophisticated. He was impromptu. And he was very thin and mobile. He was all over the place, but everybody knew him. And of course, we had sympathy. We had pity with him. He had, at this very young age, had to leave his parents. He came from a very poor background.
Was he a good-looking boy?
He was a young boy, skinny boy of 17, but a pleasant person. We all look better when we are 17, and I stayed there in Woodbury Hall. In one day, there appeared a messenger from the ministry, spoke to Major Cochrane and said that we need doctors who are serving with you. It was discovered that our medical experience would have been better used if he would be in a civilian hospital helping out to replace the absent doctors, British doctors. And the reason was that America originally sent 700 volunteer doctors from America to help out, but it seems that they didn't find London and other bombed cities very comfortable, and they went back to America. And consequently, Britain was short of doctors. And the authorities finally discovered that there were doctors serving as corporal, lance corporal of privates. There were also in the same pioneer unit solicitors and barristers, judges employed as privates, working on airfields, preparing and digging for airfields and other pioneering jobs. So I was taken to Cambridge. The camp in Woodbury Hall was very near Cambridge. And there I was fitted out with a civilian suit, and taken to the local hospital, interviewed, accepted, and there I worked in that hospital for nearly 2 years. It was an EMS hospital, which means emergency medical service, where we attended to all the soldiers who came wounded, some very seriously wounded, came from France or elsewhere, and we attended. So it was a party medical army service. after 2 years, I was moved to the Mansfield Orthopedic Hospital in Northampton. And finally to St. Mary Abbott's Hospital.
What kind of work did you do at the Emergency Medical Service Hospital in Cambridge?
So we attended to soldiers who were wounded. We also attended to soldiers who needed non-emergency treatment, like hernia repairs, tonsillectomies, removal of tonsils, and all. They were the sort of the second transit station for soldiers. There were also civilian patients, of course. I remember there were also from the Land Army female patients. And then in St. Mary Abbott's, of course, there was still the war was going on till the end of the war. I stayed on then in this country. And the reason why I stayed on was that I had heard since that my whole family was murdered by the Germans, and I had no relatives left. The additional reason was, of course, that we people who were serving in the British Army or all the Western armies were by the communists who were then established, they were considered enemy aliens. And as it may be known that some, for example, the airmen who served in Britain, in the British Air Force, came back, they were imprisoned, they were persecuted, they were imprisoned and treated badly, I would say cruelly. It was shown in a recent documentary on television, how badly they were treated, sometimes in chains, because they served in a capitalist army or air force. As I stayed in this country, I requalified in 1947, got a conjoint degree. I got a degree in anesthetic, diploma in anesthetic, and finally I got a fellowship in the Royal College of Surgeons in 1951.
How were you treated in Britain, would you say, during the Second World War?
I was treated very fairly, very hospitably. Of course, the British public knew that I am a member of the Allied forces and Allied nations, and that gave me an advantage. But I still think even the refugees who were of Austrian or German original nationality were treated most hospitably. I think Britain were most generous and most tolerant to all refugees.
Did you think that it was possible that Britain might be defeated in the Second World War and that Germans might invade the country?
We are on a continent where we are believing that Britain is such a big empire that they can't be defeated.
Did you ever come anywhere near the bombing of Britain by the German Air Force at any time?
Yes, I remember when we were in Woodbury Hall, the German planes were flying over our camp, and occasionally they wanted to get rid of the bombs, which they haven't got rid of over London. They dropped it over our camp.
You were telling me earlier that there was an occasion when a V1 hit the Colindale Hospital.
Yes, I want to come to that. That was my experience in Woodbury Hall. And And when I was in London working in Colindale Hospital, which I should have mentioned before I mentioned, St. Mary Abbott's Hospital, when I was in Colindale Hospital, we had many raids, and finally a flying bomb came down on our hospital, and we had 11 people killed, and I had a very slight injury on my hand.
Where were you when the V1 hit? Were you on duty?
Yes, I was in hospital on call. I was on call, yes, in hospital. We had to stay in hospital. I wasn't sheltering anywhere. It just happened that another wing of the hospital were hit and not my wing. And I was fortunate I wasn't in that wing. But unfortunately, the poor 11 patients were killed. I still remember one of the soldiers who was a Czech ex-soldier or patient soldier was found dead in bed with his hand sheltering his head, and his wristwatch was still walking, was still ticking. However, the war went on, and whenever I went out to London, where streets were mainly empty, I could hear the alarm go, alarm siren going, and where the V1 and V2 were expected to come. One had to be fatalistic and to take a chance, and one couldn't just stay in shelter. And I learned to ignore shelters altogether and carried on with my life and taking a chance, and one survived. So when the war ended, I was in St. Mary Abbott's. Still remember the parades, the victory parades, and I requalified.
What did the requalification involve?
It entailed that I had to go through the basic qualification to replace the MD Prague by MRCS England, LRCP London, which means Manual Royal College of Surgeons and Licensed Royal College of Physicians of London. Then I did as an extra, because I was quite fascinated by the British art of anesthetic, I did the diploma in anesthetic in England, and finally I did the fellowship in 1951.
In what way was the British art of anesthesia so different?
There were only masks. After all, time has progressed. In when I left the country in 1939, there was still only mask and drip ether used, or chloroform. And since then it progressed to nice anesthetic machines. Pentothal was used, intravenous pentothal, induction of anesthetic, and so on. It was much improved. Since then, anesthetic is further used. I remember still curare was started to be used to paralyze patients, see, to paralyze muscles with artificial respiration. There was great progress, and I was quite fascinated by this further advancement of anesthetics. But however, I remained in surgery, and the anesthetic degree helped me. It was always of great help.
Did the establishment of the National Health Service affect you at all, very much?
I didn't believe in private practice. I believed in serving, and I served always as full-time. There was nothing political about it, except that I thought that one does more service to patients being in the National Health Service and to be fully employed. I never pined for being in harness. After obtaining my qualification, especially fellowship, I was entitled to apply for a senior post. First, I was a registrar in Smedley Abbots. I saw an advertisement in Cardiff for orthopedic and surgeon and surgeon in traumatic surgery, and I was accepted and stayed in Cardiff for 24 years. I was duly promoted to consultant in orthopedic surgery and trauma, and stayed there till 1979. And then I moved to London because my two children were living in London, and my wife and I are now living in London ever since. I did a part-time job in the city of London, mainly for the reason to remain in contact with medicine, and I continued in this post in the London Wall in a practice serving community commuters working in the city till my age of 80. From that onwards, I have only done occasional voluntary medical work. I would have carried on beyond the age of 80, but the firm I was working for had amalgamate with another firm due to recession, because the city suffered from the effects of the recession. Whenever I applied for another job, they asked me the unpleasant question of how old are you, and of course that ended the interview, because very few people want to employ a man of 80.
Did you apply for British citizenship at any time?
Yes, I finally applied for British citizenship, as I felt that I could be a loyal citizen to Britain, and I obtained the certificate of naturalization in 1947.
Who attested for you?
There were three gentlemen attested. One was the medical superintendent, Dr. Cameron. The other one was Sir Max Page, who was knighted for his services as consultant orthopedic surgeon in the British forces. And finally, the very popular Tommy Handley.
How did you come to know Tommy Handley?
A member of his staff, of his team, was a patient in our hospital in St Mary Abbots, and they did their rehearsals in our hospital every week. And of course we became very friendly with all members, and Tommy Handley was very willing to attest for my character in my application for naturalization.
Did he ever get you to appear on one of his programs?
He didn't ask me to appear in person, but he had one actor to impersonate me, practically describing me in person, including my accent, with all the usual the occasional difficulties the patient have to communicate with such a continental doctor. I hope that my English has since improved.
Now, more seriously, can we deal with what happened to the rest of your family in the war, please?
Yes. When I left a letter with my cousin to hand over, I received communication from my parents who accepted my explanation that I could not take any member of family with me because it was a risky enterprise. Yes. My cousin, who took this letter over, finally emigrated to Chile. He had invited me to also to go to Chile with him. However, I felt my duty as a soldier to and as a fit man to serve in the army, and consequently I took the route through Poland. And my cousin then served, as he was in a neutral country, served as a transit station for communication my letters to my parents. In one of the letters they wrote that my twin brother, who was usually a very sturdy man, a boy, was thin, which indication that they were being starved. And finally communication ceased, and they were taken first to Theresienstadt, where they were temporarily treated, they thought, quite reasonably well, or what could be called well, humanely. But their stay in Theresienstadt didn't last very long. They were soon transferred to Auschwitz. My father went there in in January 1944, where he soon afterwards died. My mother was transferred in December 1943 from Theresienstadt. The number of the transport, of my father's transport, was DL 1016, and my brother Richard, he went at the end of February 1944. His number of transport was DS 1037. It departed on the 18th of December 1943, and he died at the end of February 1944. My twin brother, he was transported in transport CU-13 on the 1st of February 1943. Of course, that was a very, very cold season of the year, and he and another member of the transport, who is now living in Israel, who lived in the same street opposite our house, he and my twin brother Erwin were separated by the German guard. They were given, when they arrived in the evening to Auschwitz, they were given a cold shower. And after the cold shower, they were not allowed to put on their coat, clothes, till late in the morning. This treatment can be testified by the other member, by his other co-sufferer, because he's still alive in Tel Aviv. And I could easily confirm that by writing to him. He, however, he survived it, whilst my brother died of pneumonia within about 48 hours. This friend of ours, neighbor, he survived it, but he soon contacted diabetes as a result of that. And he's still suffering, of course, from diabetes, and he could easily confirm what I said. And I actually obtained this history from him when he visited us. My older brother, Richard, was married to Erna. She was transported from Theresien on the 19th of July 1944, and she and her son Daniel, who was at the time 7 years old, both of them were killed in the gas chamber. There were other relatives who were also transported, an uncle, aunt, two aunts. One aunt was also gassed, called Bertha, in the gas chamber on the 7th of March 1944. I have a list of relatives here where out of four out of their recent generation, about 92 people were killed in Auschwitz.